everybody. Welcome to the Canine Connection podcast. Today, Lori and I are incredibly excited to have Caitlin with us of Catalyst Kennels. I'm going to give you an informal intro. I met Caitlin through Lori because Lori has a puppy from Caitlin, and Caitlin lives close to Lori, which if that happened to me, I would probably own 30 dogs, but thank God she does not live close to me. And I knew that she breeds dogs for work, right? For search and rescue, sniffy type, real life jobs. And that's kind of the lines Zesty is from. And anyway, I'm always just interested in dogs and working dogs and looking at dogs and looking at puppies. So I had the opportunity a couple of times to head on over to her place, which is amazing. She has a boarding kennel. She has training classes, but she has a phenomenal breeding program. I've seen quite a number of litters over the years, and she has a phenomenal setup. And I got to meet some of her puppies. And more importantly, I got to talk to her because I just find breeders absolutely fascinating. And I'm going to let her tell you about a breeding program she's doing for the government because it's super interesting. And I found that really fascinating. And then more recently, I think we mentioned in an earlier episode that on my way to the New Hampshire Regional, I went up there, met Lori, and we stopped at Caitlin's home, actually, and we looked at some puppies. And we talked about how we decided on Salty for Lori.
How you decided on Salty.
Yeah.
And we just had to throw Salty in there.
We had to. And Caitlin and I talked about him a little bit, and I was like, oh, this is so good. We're going to go totally down in the weeds about puppies and picking performance puppies and all things puppies, puppies, puppies. Yay, puppies.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing I think we should start with is, because I think it's super fascinating, is Caitlin telling us about this program she's doing with raising puppies for the government, which is the worst way of explaining it. So therefore, she's going to explain it.
Oh, that sums it up. So, thank you guys for having me on. I'm Kate Graham. I own Catalyst Kennels. We're based out of Litchfield, Connecticut. And so we do have a pet side to the business where we do boarding, some day school stuff, training stuff, nose work classes. And then we also have our working dog side of the business. And that's really where I had started things and is our overall and main goal. So within our breeding program, we raise and train single purpose detection dogs. So typically narcotics, explosives, or tracking dogs, some that go on to different careers too. So different subsets, electronics or human remains or other search and rescue avenues. And so we breed specifically for those jobs. And then we keep a good number of dogs back each year to raise up through the kind of green dog development and get them ready and prepped for those careers. So within that breeding program, that's been going on a little over 10 years now.
Can I just interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
Because this is what I find fascinating. Well, you don't have to answer this question, but how old are you?
I'm 31.
Yeah, you're so young.
So
and
young.
You've been doing
I don't always
10
feel it.
Years. And
yes.
Like, to me, that's amazing. I love when women start businesses, but like, no, I really do. I get super excited about that because, you know, owning a business, starting a business, it's very hard. But you're so young and you've been doing it already for so long.
And
that's so amazing.
And Caitlin and her husband are raising a family to boot with a youngster on tow. Right, Kate? So there's additional layer of busy work.
So much life. Exactly. And so, and all of that just comes from the dog world being such a cool place. Because I grew up showing dogs. So I was so lucky to have a a neighbor growing up who bred Gordon setters and had all of these fancy, like, Westminster group winning Gordon setters. And so she would take me along and took me under her wing to do all kinds of things. And I grew up in an area where I was so lucky to have a training facility nearby that let me do agility classes and rally and obedience and all of that. But I grew up in a boarding kennel and I started working there from well before I could drive. And my mom would drive me back and forth to the kennel every day for work. And it was just such a good way to grow up. And the dog world is such a welcoming place for young people for the most part. There's a lot of people who want to support juniors and want to support young people in the sports. So that was awesome. And that really gave me a huge leg up. And then started doing search and rescue dogs when I was about 19. I joined the first search and rescue team I was on. And again, just very lucky to have good people, good support that helped kind of get me to where I am now and make a lot of the connections that have been important for where I am now. So that helped a ton with that. And I ended up actually going through a 4-year degree program that was in animal science with a canine concentration. The program itself was good, but the connections I made from it way more so. And that kind of hooked me up into the very beginning of when we were raising and training and starting young dogs. And so while I was in college, I got off campus housing and had a professor who was, very generous with time and knowledge to teach me how to raise young dogs. And so we had, full normal college classes. And then on the side, this hobby turned passion project turned second career of raising and training and selecting young dogs for detection work and raising them up. And then that's just kind of continued and naturally dovetailed into a bit of a breeding program kind of set up. And again, was lucky through places like some of the service dog schools where got into working with some of our progressive genetic tools and looking at things like estimated breeding values and managing breeding programs and breeding colonies for service dog schools that allowed me to have and access a lot of the tools that we can use to create stronger breeding programs, even on a small scale like I have. So my breeding program has been going on about 10 years. It was usually a side, again, I can't even call it a hobby, a side second job to my real job, which for a while was director of canine wellness, which included all breeding program management for a service dog school. So I got to manage their colony. And with that, and some of the databases that they have access to, and some of the closed genetic pools that we have within service dog stuff, we can look at things like estimated breeding values and again, some of our predictive genetics, which I think absolutely at some point will translate over into our performance dog world or our detection world. It'll just take a little bit longer to get there. So yeah, I started there. And then while I was in that position, I had been breeding one or two litters a year, mostly for either when I needed my next search and rescue dog or for other people that were looking for very similar type things. But kept it very small. I only had a couple bitches, and again, one or two litters a year was kind of the max of what I did. I got involved and kind of roped into an opportunity during COVID to join something called the Domestic Breeding Initiative, which was formerly the Domestic Breeding Consortium. And so that is a federally funded project. It's under the umbrella of Homeland Security, their Science and Technology Division. And then Johns Hopkins University, their applied physics lab, is the organizational partner. So they handle all of the data collection, research, and the organization of the program. And so this program was seeking pilot participants for a effort to evaluate the ability to create a more stable domestic supply of odor detection canines, specifically explosive detection canines. And the reason for this project coming about is the majority, vast majority of the dogs that we get for explosive detection or other odor detection work in both the federal and municipal capacity come from overseas. Most of our dogs are imported. Most of them come from Eastern Europe and several other countries, but we have a very, very heavy foreign reliance on,
Getting
importing dogs for
dogs.
detection work.
Wow.
Yep. So a lot of them come from over across the pond. And so
Are they
federally, this was
labs?
a,
Are they labs or
So
different breeds?
labs, short hairs, a couple other pointy breed or pointer-ish breeds, and then our Malinois and Shepherds, our
Right.
Dutchies. Those are predominantly coming from somewhere in Europe, or again, somewhere overseas. Sometimes we don't know exactly where they're coming from, but they get imported into here, and then we figure out who they are. So there's a really heavy reliance, and some statistics say like over 80% of our dogs come imported from
Wow.
there.
Wow.
So federally, this is a concern point, and they wanted to start throwing some money into how can we have more of those dogs come from here,
Yeah.
and not have to import so many, because anything that we're looking from a defense budget, we're, importing that much, that's concerning. So one of,
Kate, let me just ask you, what is the reason for the lack of domestic breeding in to source dogs from our own country? Like what is the cause of that? Is it just lack of breeding programs that
I think
can
lack of breeding programs at scale. Culturally, it's not a well-recognized activity or hobby. So if we look at a lot of the European countries, it is very common for someone to raise a dog to sell to an agency. Like that is a normal, in many of these countries, kind of normal place hobby. And also there, when we look at even some of our like agricultural industry, it is a market over there. It is absolutely an industry over there to produce dogs for detection work. And because they've been doing it for so long, they have a scale that they can do it at. And for better or for worse, but there are lots of people over there who have figured out how to do it very well. And so they have the numbers, they have the mass. If we look at
Oh, we lost Kaylin. Does she know we lost her? Can
I
you
don't
text
know.
her?
Let me text her.
Dogs.
Oh, wait, we
Oh,
lost you
sorry. Can you
briefly.
guys hear me?
Yep, now we can.
Now we
Okay.
can, but we lost
Perfect.
you.
Sorry.
So you
Just
might
go
have to
back. Go
repeat.
back. Like, yeah, go back a little bit.
Perfect. Okay. So when we look over, in Europe at kind of how they raise dogs, they can raise large numbers of dogs. They have a large number of people. It is a profitable industry over there. They have the scale, the kind of setups and facilities, and just infrastructure in place to be able to raise dogs at scale, and the experience and the knowledge for the most part to be able to do it quite well. So just as we might see some of our, other smaller kind of niche agricultural industries over here, dogs are that over there. And when we're looking at federal agencies who are procuring hundreds of dogs a year, they can go over to Europe. They can look at 100 dogs on a clip, in a week-long procurement trip. They can select 60 or 70 or whatever they need, and they can import them and bring them back. That simply doesn't exist over here at scale right now. We don't have facilities where you can go and see that many dogs or where we can procure that many dogs at one time. And again, part of it over here is cultural. We don't raise dogs like that. We don't raise dogs en masse like that. Just our costs and our infrastructure to set something like that up is astronomical. If you don't have a facility vet, if you don't have, that it would be so intangible to be able to raise that many dogs
Yeah,
and
with
sell them for
staff and
profit.
yeah, for sure.
So it's not something we have set up really well here. And then our other issue that we have is there is no great access point for smaller scale breeders who may be producing great dogs to be able to source federally currently. So currently, the federal government, most of our agencies operate on something called bulk purchase agreements, or they have a couple other terms, but they're looking for a certain number of dogs at a time. And usually that number is a minimum of 20 or so. Most vendors and most kind of breeders and people raising dogs aren't raising the 30 dogs required at a time to be able to guarantee that they will have 20 for an agency when they come to pick up at any given time, because our, kind of notice period on those might only be a month or two. So most breeders and vendors can't say, oh, yep, I can wrangle together that many dogs for you at one time. And, our industry is pretty well isolated to a dozen or so vendors that can do that. And so we miss out on a lot of the smaller guys like me, who I can't have 20 dogs, a guaranteed 20 dogs ready on a month's notice. I don't have that many dogs in my facility. I don't want to raise that many dogs at a time. And so that would pretty much preclude me from being able to source to our federal agencies. So all of those things were addressed in the domestic breeding initiative kind of project, and looking at how can we get either access points for those smaller breeders to be able to sell dogs to federal agencies? How can we improve the quality of the dogs, the longevity of the dogs, the how can we reduce our dropout rates? And so there were a lot of different pieces and facets within that program, and there are people that are absolutely both authorized and educated to speak on the program much better than I can. But overall, I was attracted to the program because it is something where they were looking to both collect data and research to look at the operational effectiveness of our dogs and the development of dogs, and see if there were certain markers and behavioral traits that we could look at a younger age to help determine if that dog was likely to wash out or be successful within a program. And then also, it provided me a sole source contract. So I have the ability to tell TSA or some of these other agencies that, hey, I have five dogs that I'm going to have ready that are part of this program to look at. And it sets it up where they will come look at and procure and test those dogs. And so now I'm able to sell to federal agencies that prior to that, I would not have had access to. And no, my five dogs or eight dogs or whatever it is at a time is not changing the face and providing them all the dogs they need for things. But if we get a whole bunch
Enough
of breeders
people,
who can do
yeah,
that, yep, then that
right.
starts to make a difference. And so Johns Hopkins University, again, their applied physics lab, and they have a super cool team over there that are working on creating this framework to hopefully create a more stable domestic source of dogs for detection work.
Nice.
And so that's kind of it in a nutshell. And then also through that, they conduct quite a few behavioral evaluations on those dogs. They look at certain biologic samples to be able to genotype and look at if we can start to find some other genetic links with what makes a dog successful and not. And then they're also really great with they collect information from all of us breeders on all different scales. So I am a very small partner in that program. There are some partners who are breeding 20 litters a year. There are some partners who are breeding in a kind of more university setting. So it has a variety of different business models within the domestic breeding initiative. And then they also collect data from us from just kind of our experiences and everything. So we submit information for how we whelp litters, why we do it that way, how we raise puppies, why we do it that way, what we're doing with their early development, et cetera, so that they're able to collect all those data points and help figure out how we can both create more efficiencies and also a more stable structure to hopefully support more breeders to be able to support this federal and municipal demand for odor detection canines.
I love that.
So when
That's really
you
cool.
breed a litter for them per se,
Yep.
right? Do you raise them differently than you would, for example, if you bred another litter and you're like, this litter's geared towards performance
Sports,
people
yeah.
or
Yeah, how,
Yeah,
yeah.
yes.
Tell us like how, from whelping to that by the time they're ready to go, like what that looks like.
Absolutely. And it happens before they're even born. So I will say my litters that we craft and design for performance and even some of our search and rescue homes are usually a little bit different genetically than the litters I am looking at for something like the Domestic and Breeding Initiative project. So when we're looking at selling to both federal and municipal agencies, dogs that are going to have their primary purpose in life be to have a full-time explosive or odor detection career, I am looking at a dog that is going to be a tool. And I am looking at a dog that is going to be a tool for a handler that only has the skills and ability that that handler has. And I need a dog whose primary function in life is to do its job. Its primary function in life is not to be a good companion in the house. It is not to be a pleasant dog to be around. It is to do its job and do its job very, very well. And so often with those litters, I will say for the most part, the litters that we are designing for that are not actually the best sport or performance prospects. Or even for some of our handlers looking for search and rescue dogs, those litters do not always produce the same things genetically. So my domestic breeding initiative litters, and with those litters, one of the caveats is we have to keep back that entire litter to raise. So if we designate it for them and we have nine puppies in that litter, we have to retain the ability to perform evaluations on those puppies throughout their 12-month birthday. And we are to raise most of those dogs, except for some that we may breeding designate, for the intent of being sourced for federal procurement. So we might have, my younger litter is six, so all six are being raised for that purpose. They are going to have to deal with some things in life that are going to be a little bit different than what a pet dog deals with. If they go to TSA, they're going to be going down to Lackland Air Force Base. That's where a lot of the agencies have their training programs. They are going to be in a kennel with hundreds of other dogs. They are going to be primarily living in a kennel. They have to be able to deal with that through their development and training while they're down there. Now, with TSA and a bunch of other the agencies, they will end up going home with a handler once they're graduated and paired and all of that. And so that's awesome for them. But they have to be able to withstand the kennel environment during that training process. They have to be able to withstand having a multitude of different handlers and trainers. They have to be able to deal with having someone that they have no idea who it is pull them out of the kennel and work them and work at the same level, whether they know that person or like that person or don't. And then they get paired with a handler who often has, or quite frankly, a lot of them have never held a leash before,
Zero,
never had
zero,
any type of
zero
animal.
dog
And this
skills.
dog needs to be strong enough to be able to deal with a handler fucking up the end of their leash. And the dog goes, screw you, I'm just doing my job, leave me alone.
Whenever you say that, I'm always just like, I just imagine these dogs coming out of the kennel and being handed to some person who's
Oh, it's a
never
shit
even
show
like
half the
walked a
time.
dog in their life. It's oh my God.
Oh yeah, but you need a special kind of dog to be able to deal with someone, messing with their leash, to be able to, we really need the dogs to be able to just work despite the handlers often. And then the
So,
handler skills will improve and come along, but yeah.
is this just a dog that's just a crackhead? Like, it's like all I care about
Yeah,
is
it's an
working.
interesting. Yes. So for the most part, now arousal comes into play, and we can talk about like drive and arousal later. Can't be a super high arousal dog just because of the environment that I have to work in and what the dog has to do performance-wise, but must be so innately driven that we as a handler don't need to bring much to the table to motivate the dog. The dog is motivated intrinsically either by the work and by its reward system. So like when I'm looking at those litters, possession and toy motivation is a huge thing. I need a dog who doesn't just like toys, but if we have a handler who the most interaction this handler is going to do is just give the dog a ball at the end of its search and stand there and be blank faced, I need a dog that likes its ball that much that it's going to be willing to work those hours of work just to get its ball and stand there with its ball. Because we don't have the handlers bringing a ton to the table. And again, most of these handlers are going to develop great skills and a great rapport with the dog, and it comes along in time. But at first, it's messy. And we need a dog who can handle that. So we're looking for a lot of, again, motivation to possess and kind of maintain control of an item, usually a ball or a tug or whatever. And we're also putting these dogs into programs that are traditionally designed for pointier dogs, or shepherds, or Malinois, or whatever, and are based off of a dog who is uber possessive of its toy. And so the program does not change. I can't play fetch with a dog in the airport. That doesn't functionally work. I can't play fetch with a dog roadside when it's doing a car sniff for narcotics. I need a dog that's content to go, okay, did it, and I have my toy, and maybe, it's a toy, it's gonna just smush in its mouth. Maybe the handler's gonna play some tug. But we need to make sure we're crafting a dog who genetically is gonna have the tools to be content with being rewarded in that method. And
And
actually really, really into that.
they need to be resilient,
Yes, so
right?
resilient. They need to be able to handle a lot of inadvertent pressure from the handler. And again, we're talking detection tasks. The handler can't give the dog the answer. The handler can't direct the dog to find the information. The dog needs to be confident and self-possessed enough to
Oh,
be able to do that on their own, and to want to do that on their own. So for detection purposes, especially when we're looking at that side of it, yes, I need a dog who can work with a person and is amenable to a person's opinions and suggestions. But at the end of the day, the dog goes, I am the one actually who knows what my task and job is. Again, you need to follow suggestions, you need to work with me, but the dog is leading the team there. And so we want a dog who's willing to do that. Now, performance-wise, that's not always ideal. And that's not always useful for us for a lot of our performance objectives. So we might want a dog that's a little bit more of a team player. Those team player dogs, though, I might have a hard time sourcing to my first time handler, either federal or municipal, that the handler's going, "I don't know, buddy, what do you think?" And the dog's going, "I don't know either. What are we doing?" And it can get messy quick. So I need that dog who goes, "Screw you, I'm doing my job. Just
Follow
follow
me.
along behind me. Yep, and let's go."
When you talk about the toy, the method of reinforcement with the toy, wanting them just to have like just some sort of just benign act of here's your toy. We don't need to necessarily go into this active game. Is that, are you starting that out with these puppies right from the get-go, like developing that insane just want for that reinforcer?
So that starts right off the beginning, and how we do it starts kind of right from the beginning. So unlike some of our, dogs that might be going to other agencies like USAR, where we see a lot of really interactive play and a lot of like, "Oh my God, here's your toy, get it, get it, get it, yay, we're playing with it." We typically try to, when they're even really little, the toy is the most exciting piece of the game, and we actually keep a handler completely out of it. So we do a lot of flirt pull stuff, a lot of the puppy on a harness. The toy is what's kind of being animated. The puppy can create animation in the toy by how much effort it puts into trying to get to the toy. Puppy is then able to work through, okay, push a little bit through pressure, can get the toy. And then when we get the puppy has grabbed the toy, and is maintaining possession on that toy and holding that toy. We're working it a little bit more like we might work a dog starting in bite work, where we're, allowing that toy to kind of stay alive. But as soon as you let that toy go, it's going to run away. And so we want to keep that toy in our mouth. We want to continue to possess that toy. It's very self-reinforcing to possess that toy and hold on to it. But while all of this is ha happening, the handler is not stepping in and going, "Oh my God, that's so good. Nice job." No, it's a game between the dog. It's a game between the toy and the dog. It is not a game that involves people at first. And so that kind of foundation often helps build the attitude that we're looking for. If the dog is just so motivated to get and possess its toy and not let its toy go, and we're not having to put as much support in, we can always add more, through good, proper play mechanics and being able to create good engagement games with the dog. But quite frankly, when they come out to test my dogs, they're not doing that. They're giving the dog a toy. They're standing there for 30 seconds saying nothing. And does that dog, continue to be interested and motivated in its toy, or does it go, "Oh, well, if you don't want it either, then I guess I'm going to drop it and move along." We need that dog who's going to be quite content to just go, "Yeah, I got my toy. Like,
Yeah,
I
screw
don't
you. I
really
don't
give a
need
shit what
to.
you're doing." Yeah,
Right.
exactly.
Oh
And
my
then the
God,
engagement piece would
it's
always
the
help.
absolute definition of Zayna. She
Let's
ended up in the wrong place. She should be working at an airport.
Zayna's brother, I'll have we're planning, I think, this spring to breed. Let's see, they would be Remy grand puppies. So yeah,
Oh
similar to that. But I'm like, yeah,
yes.
that's
Zayna, but Remy is biddable.
he is
Zayna
with yep.
is not at all. Like, she is everything you described. She is
Lovely.
so freaking confident. Like, she owns the planet. Nothing fazes her. She will play all by herself all day long as a tiny little puppy. She was gone in my yard entertaining herself, and I went, oh boy, this is gonna be, I'm gonna have to work really hard to matter. And the truth of the matter is, I still really don't matter. She's still not working for me. She's working for her reinforcer, right? That's what
And
she's working for.
that's really, and it's so like that's the exact that hits the nail on the head. That's what I'm looking for dogs to go into certain roles for professional detection work. I need that dog that is working for its reinforcer, for its job. Because again, I don't get to pick the handler. And a lot of times we look at the handler and go, "Ooh, that's going to be a little bit rough." We don't get to select that. So we need a dog who can work despite the handler. But, and I'm sure you could speak to it as Zaina, that presents different challenges for our performance sports and our team-based sports, and that's not always the most ideal. And so when we
No.
look at the most ideal puppy for a certain task, that does not make that puppy kind of the most ideal for another task or role. They all fit in different parts of the spectrum, and the roles require different temperaments, different behaviors, and different genetic traits. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just going to interrupt and say, because this is where I think people can get it wrong when they're looking at puppies, right? And they want they love the puppy who's, you know, and this is for performance sports when they want a teammate and they're like, oh no, I want the puppy, the one that's climbing out of the box, the one that's got the toy and doesn't want to give it back, the one that's a psycho. Mm-hmm. And then, like, that's where people get it wrong, because I remember when I first met you, Kate, and I was like, oh my God, I love all these dogs. What about these dogs? And you were like, oh, no, you don't want those dogs. Those are the jerky asshole dogs.
Yeah. They're really fun for other things.
Well, the thing is they look like they seduce you, because they are like driven, and they are like all the crazy things. Like, you want that drive. Everyone goes to, I want drive and arousal. But at the end of the day, then you can end up with a dog who does not give a shit what you think. Hint, hint, Zayna. Mm-hmm.
Well, and
that, yeah.
They're so tough, right? Like, yes. Dana in a search, 300%. If I'm like, oh, I think it's there, she'd be like, you're stoned. It's here. There would be no question in her mind, right? Like, that's how she is in life. She's, well, not just her, I should say, all my dogs, really, because I get the crackheads. But I also learned a very long time ago, I did field work with field trial people, really good field trial people that taught me how to manage these dogs. And it is management in life 24/7.
Yeah.
People never see that. I tell them stories. I hike. They're like, oh, I do too. I'm like, no, you don't. You are not
like that.
Racing through the woods for an hour and a half.
When you're tired.
Up and down trails with your dogs running full bore the entire time, not even staying on the trail. I don't know where they're half the time. They're over here. They're over there. They're bringing me animal body parts. They're leaping up and down walls.
Well, like, and it's not like an optional thing. Like, it's got to, it's not the lifestyle optional for these dogs. Yeah. Like, I can't not take my dogs out. Like, you know what I mean?
No.
Like, they need those needs need to be met for these kinds of dogs for sure. Like, you can't just not attend to that for whatever amount of days, else you're going to be royally fucked in the house. Like,
and life skills. Like, my dogs are on the dining room table. They think that's hilarious. Get down, right? Why should I get down? I said get down, but I really, you know, like, honey, no. You're not supposed to get down. She'd be like, you're, you know, like, it's that, it's managing them in life, like teaching a recall to a dog like that. Like, there's so much to it. And they see my dogs in the ring. And I can't tell you how many people, who's your breeder? And I'm like, you don't want one of these.
No, it's not going to be a pleasant dog for you. And, you know, it is the management piece, because Teb Ever's mom is 12. She should be able to be loose in the house when I'm not home for a little bit. The amount of work I have to go through to contain my dog food, because it has just been a task of hers to figure out how to do this. This dog can go through Vittles vault. She will go and figure out how to undo any cabinet latch, all of that. And then you come home and she's just food gorged herself and she looks like a little tick. So, you know, it's constant management in these things, because they're just going to continue to find things. And again, they will continue through their whole life to find things to get into. We can't ask for that much persistence and go and intensity in the work and then expect it to just be non-existent in the home. No. Yes, my dogs right now are all sleeping around the house and they're being good, but they hiked this morning. We have done other things to make it so that they can have this off switch and nicely kind of coexist. And it's still a huge amount of management. And so that dog is not always the dog that people want. And so I was just watching a bunch of my dogs compete in agility over at the Thanksgiving cluster. Mm. So that's always fun. And it's nice to be able to see a whole variety of dogs go. And it's so funny because we have quite a few dogs who I laugh at, and they are so fun for the handlers to run, and they are so sexy to watch. They are fast. They are flashy. They are whatever. You know, the dogs that are way more consistent and way more titled and kind of all of that are the ones that are a little bit more moderate. And those are the ones that are being super successful because they care about keeping bars up. They care about watching where their body is.
And that's
they're
the
willing
word
to work with.
Yeah. That's the word
about,
I use.
They care about pleasing their hands.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. They want to work nicely in team. The dogs who don't give a shit, who are just flat out, I mean, they are so fun to watch, but they are also way harder to get to qualify. Like,
Yeah.
again, I have some awesome handlers who are like, nah, this is just fun, and it's an
Yeah.
adrenaline dump every time you run them. But they're not qualifying nearly as much. They're
Right.
not moving up through the levels. They're not going to be your national level team because the dog just doesn't give a shit about the precision involved. It's
Right.
just going to go as fast as it freaking can, and if shit happens, shit happens. But they don't care quite as much about the fact that, ooh, this was a problem. They're just going flat out.
Yeah.
And so, again, fun to watch, but that's not the kind of dog that I'm telling, especially most either novice handlers or handlers who are really caring about competing at a very high level. That's not the kind of dog I think you want for that.
Yeah, and that's where I think people have that misconception, because they go and they see all those dogs run and they see that sexiness and that fast and oh my God, I want to do that. And then they just don't understand the flip side to that coin with living with them and the fact that they really aren't as careful. They don't really care as much. You're going to struggle more trying to reach those higher goals that you're looking for at the competitive level because you have a dog that may be fast, but isn't gonna care two shits about precision or being careful with its feet, you know? Yeah.
Well, the other piece of it too is drive, arousal, like managing that. Like, it's such a hot topic right now. And the reason it's a hot topic is because it's challenging and because people innately they get a dog and you do not innately know how to manage that, and it can spiral out of control very quickly, and then you can hit a point relatively early on in a dog's career where you're kind of at the point of no return. Like, you just can never real and I've seen this happen so many times. The dog either washes out, maybe they keep the dog, but it can't do the sport they want, or it can't do a sport at all. And they kind of are like, well, it's the dog. And I'm always like, it's not the dog. It's the trainer didn't ha and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, because like I said, it's very complicated and hard. The trainer did not have the skill set and the understanding of arousal and the ability to manage it, so that it channels, because I picture it like this giant burst of energy that just explodes all over the place. And if, unless you have the ability to take it, squeeze it all into this laser beam. And then when you have the laser beam, you have what ultimately everybody sees and wants. If someone has that sexy dog, and they have the skill set, and they can manage it and control it, which is rare,
It's
right?
so rare.
Yeah. And
So
so
rare.
that's where I think a huge misconception and huge problems arise, because, you know, even when I'll tell some people, I'll be, don't get that dog, don't. And then I look later on, oh, they got the dog. I'm like, God damn it, this is going to be a disaster. Yep, it's a disaster. And it's because they couldn't manage their arousal. Like, and I have a lot of experience with it. I have many dogs with it. And still, like, it's something I'm working on in my competition training, like, constantly, constantly. And I teach on it all the time. And I see how hard it is for students to process it, to read it, to manage it, to adjust it in real time.
Especially those who don't have that experience, you know.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes too, it's still so commonplace. We're having so many more discussions now between like what is drive, what is arousal,
Yeah.
and recognizing that they are two separate things.
Yeah.
But I think it's so important to parse out, I'm always looking genetically. They are absolutely two different pieces. Drive, and it's so hard to define drive because we go, is there drive? Is there not drive? Is it intrinsic? Is it extrinsic? Whatever. But
Right.
if we're looking at like, are we calling it motivators? Are we calling it work ethic? What are we calling it? To me, it goes, it's the desire to complete your task with the maximum amount of intensity and efficiency. And the efficiency piece is important because if you're not completing your task properly and efficiently, then that doesn't do me any good. And so, for example, right, if we're looking at search and rescue and I am clearing a 40-acre problem and you are running just in circles and for the first 10 minutes not even searching, I don't have the time to stand there for 10 minutes and let you get your shit out and or go, oh, hey, these first 5 acres we cleared, dog's probably not actually clearing them because he's not working well. Now he's dialed in and settled in, and now he's working. No, I need the work right off the bat. So I want the efficiency immediately. So
That's a
that's what I'm
great, and
looking at.
that's a great word to use there, that efficiency. Like I always go back to, like when I'm talking to people, I always go back to the example of like a working line border collie on a farm, working livestock. Like that efficiency needs to be there 100%. Because any wasted amount of time is the loss of flock or the endangerment to that flock or that herd, right?
We
So
can't have
it's
that border
huge.
collie getting so excited running out to go get sheep in the morning that he's scattering them and then
Exactly.
before he's even able to get in. We need the efficiency right off the bat. And
And
so, as
what does that drive look like? I always say that too. You know what I mean? Like that frenetic behavior that you're seeing that looks fun is not efficient drive. You know what I
No,
mean?
nope. My human remains dog, right? I may go into environments and what she does, we do a lot of trace evidence stuff for another federal agency, which is really cool. And so I need her to be able to search a threshold as soon as we walk in a room for a drop of blood or a drop of cleaned up blood. So I need her frequency of sniffing to be extremely high. I need her to be working with a great amount of intensity. However, she cannot be doing laps around the room because we're missing something. I need her to have all of that intensity focused into such a tiny little area that she can detail so closely, but with such care and intensity that we're not missing those little things. So the behavior is not always this giant explosive expression of behavior, but it is an intense amount of intensity and efficiency within the task. And so that I feel like we can control a little bit more genetically, that level of drive or motivation, to me is something that I think we're able to look at and manipulate, genetically a little bit more so. But then when we're looking at arousal, I always think of arousal and I just from my education and all that, I was always taught arousal on the spectrum of like Yerkes-Dodson curve. So, the relationship between arousal and performance. And so it's on an inverted bell curve. And when we're really low arousal, kind of we have our or let's see. So we're on an inverted bell. And for those of you who don't know Yerkes-Dodson curve, look it up. It's a really simple concept. But it's this idea that there is a optimal level of performance. And that is when a task is performed the most beautifully that task could be performed. It is efficient, it is precise, everything is coming together. And we've all been there with our dogs where we just go, oh, that just felt good. So there is that optimal level of performance. And then we have arousal on a separate axis on this kind of chart. And arousal is going to run from the spectrum of very, very low arousal to very high arousal. When we're very low arousal, we are not going to have the highest level of performance. We are going to be operating in a state where performance may be sluggish. We may get distracted. We may not have focus, or we may just have a lack of energy to be able to perform the task. As we move towards the middle of that curve, or that middle of that kind of ideal arousal point, we will reach a point in which the performance of the task is as beautiful as it could be. But then we can also go too high on that arousal level where all of a sudden, I mean, we talk about it in dogs all the time. We just don't know always, I think, where it comes from, but they're over the top. So they get over the top of that curve where performance starts to sharply decline because we have too much arousal in the situation and no longer is the dog able to maintain appropriate
Optimal,
mental focus. Yep, they're no longer working in that optimal state. So that I always think of as like we're tuning the switch on a radio. Like we go from that like static to a little bit of crackly. Like, all right, we're starting to hear some words, we're starting to hear some things, we're getting closer to optimal arousal. You hit that one little bit on the dial where it's perfect and crystal clear. And then as soon as you go a little bit further away from it, we start to lose everything again. And we start to get crackly and then we get into full on static. So I want that perfect point where I can hear everything crystal clear. And that's what I'm looking for. And arousal, I feel like, is something that we can manipulate more so than we can manipulate a dog's, ability to have the drive. I think dogs, personally, I think dogs are born on the spectrum with they have a maximum ceiling for the drive or the motivation they are able to put into a task. And we can build them up to that point, but we're not, there's only so much that we can put into that.
Right,
but
and we're gonna
arousal,
we can manufacture manipulate that a little far bit more. Yeah, for sure.
Right, right.
So what are you let's talk a little bit about, like, when are you starting to really start to see these differences in arousal drive in your puppies? And, like, you know, what are you telling people who are interested in specific litters? Like, let's get into that a little bit, because of how we, you know, I think we've talked about this before a lot, like three of us even, you know, where people have that misconception of what they're looking for, what they want.
Right. And so I look at it even, I mean, we start seeing it at 4 and 5 weeks, and we have three opportunities a day to see it, because we see it every day when that litter is having their meals prepared for them, or just when mom steps out of the box. And sometimes we start to see it then. We will see the dogs who can be efficient in their tasks or efficient in trying to reach the goals that they are trying to reach. So if we do a lot with like food puzzles and things like that, and not like a physical food puzzle, but like there is an X pen between you and the food bowl, or there is a barrier, or there is some other stressor that you must either cross or overcome or work around to be able to access your food item, or we started even younger, or your dam. And we will see the puppies who are in such a high state of arousal that they are expending and just leaking so much energy on either screaming or spinning or running frantically. And then you see the puppies who get gritty right off the bat and just go, all right, buckle in, let's figure this shit out. And so I think we can see that. I tend to see that start even 4 or 5 weeks, my puppies who are going to handle things by just throwing more energy at it, or my puppies who are going to handle things by throwing, you know, that are going to efficiently work through a stressor.
And those puppies, Kate, may look a little more moderate than the other puppies.
Usually do. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because usually... I mean, people equate, like, so I hear this all the time, right? This was a thing. And I very early on, I kind of got sucked into that, but then I'm always like curious, so I always want to know. So I got all this information, then I was like, oh, okay. Like, quote unquote, pick of the litter. Yeah. I want pick of the litter. I'm getting pick of the litter, or the breeder's giving me pick of the litter. And we feel really good about that, right? It makes us feel special and like, oh, I'm getting pick of the litter. But like, what is that even? And most people, like, I think we mentioned earlier, pick of the litter might look on the surface like that wild and crazy dog, or, you know, like,
yeah.
And I'm always quite like, frankly, dude, like, pick of the litter means, to me, it means I get to pick the puppy that matches the best to me, that meets the traits I want, which I'm very, very specific on, right? Like, I write it out.
Yes.
And I give it to the person.
And absolutely.
I like, you know, I like to also look at the puppies myself, individual, except like we can get into that later. But like, that should not be the same puppy that someone else wants. So they could also be getting quote unquote pick of the litter, because they're picking the dog that's best for them. In that litter.
So, and I hate the pick of the litter stuff, because it is so subjective. Breeder's favorite puppy in the litter, or is it the best puppy for you in the litter? And I think a lot of times it does manifest as just that most explosive puppy in the litter. And quite frankly, a lot of times, fuck that puppy. That's usually the puppy that's giving me the most grief to deal with as I'm raising them up. They might turn out to be brilliant, or they might crash and burn, but it's often much more of a roller coaster than we want to embark down. And so I always tell people when they talk to me about they want a puppy and we're looking at litters and whatever, and they talk to me, I say, build me your dream dog. Let's, you know, talk to me. What are the things you like? What are the things you don't like? And we'll go right from the beginning, just when we're starting to even look at size and structure. You know, do you have certain preferences on how a dog is built, what size a dog is? Different sports are going to lend themselves well to different physical attributes. And hey, I might say after a conversation, I'm not going to have the puppy for you, but I want to talk about and kind of parse out what things are most important to you. So we're going to talk about the phenotypic stuff. What does the dog look like? How is it put together? What things drive you crazy? I know personally for me, and it's so stupid, I hate a dog with loose eye rims, like a droopy-eyed dog. It drives me fucking nutty. I don't care how nice the dog is. I can't live with it in my house. Like, it drives me fucking crazy.
No droopy
So,
eyes.
like,
I
no
like
droopy eyes.
it. I Zesty's
But
a little droopy. Isn't
there
Zesty a
you
little
go.
droopy,
Yeah,
Lori? I think
he's
I'll be
got,
a little droopy.
yeah,
Yeah,
and
he's got a little droop. He's got
That's
a little droop.
A big, but for me, it just drives
I'm
me
not
nutty. It
offended.
bugs me all the time. Like, it's one of those things I know it's going to drive me crazy about that dog. So it's stupid, but for me, I go,
That's
eh,
hilarious.
whatever. But some of those little things matter. Some of us have some weird quirks and
That's
dogs have
okay.
certain shit. So it is. And then I want to talk to that person about, okay, how do you like to interact with a dog? You know, what is kind of your style of handler engagement, whether you have a dog already or whether you don't and you're just watching other? Are you a super hands-on handler who really is high energy and bringing a ton of, you know, a ton to the table yourself? Or are you a more laid-back handler? How do you like the dog to interact with you and behave with that? Because if I have a handler who wants to be, you know, super high energy and they're bringing a lot to the table and they're a handler who is very busy and fast and all of that, in some sports, that might be good to pair them up with a dog who is going to match that. In other sports, we might need a dog who helps ground some of that out or isn't going to get spun up and over the top by that. So we've got to look at things like that. And then, you know, just other things that when I ask people, what kind of quirks do you like or how do you like a dog to interact with you? You know, personally, I don't like a dog who's going to be easily offended. I don't like a dog who's going to go, "Oh, I'm sorry," if they do something wrong. And that's just my style. I know it will bug and annoy me to work with a dog that is constantly apologizing to me, if I have put too much pressure on it. So I choose dogs to live with that aren't gonna apologize because I don't like dealing with that. But talking to that handler about, okay, what are your goals? Yes, let's see where you're gonna go. And that, you know, I look at, okay, let's stack all the cards in our favor. Do we have a pedigree that has proven to produce dogs similar to what you are looking for? Do we have the health clearances and, you know, structure that is going to support what you are looking for? Okay, we have checked those boxes. Now let's talk through individual preferences. You know, how do you want to work this dog? What type of interactions do you like with your dog? What type of reward systems do you like with your dog? All of that. And that's going to help us look at, is this litter going to be a fit? And then within this litter, let's create a diverse wait list so that we don't have every puppy going, okay, I've got five, you know, Loris on my list that are all looking for top quality obedience prospects. Because quite frankly, I'm probably not going to have five of those. I would rather keep a list and kind of a variety in my people for each litter that, okay, I have a person that wants a search and rescue dog. I have a person that wants a competition obedience dog. I have a person that wants agility dog. And I can kind of plug and play those puppies and their strengths and weaknesses into the home that they are going to best thrive in. So I always want to talk to that person about, again, what is your dream dog? Dream dogs are not reality, that's imagination. But you know, what would it look like if everything came together and you had everything you wanted? And then let's see, does this litter support genetically that it should fit those goals? And if it does, let's now start to look through those puppies and see if there's someone that supports that. So my pick puppy for one person is going to be very different than pick per puppy for another
Yeah,
person.
right.
And even within the same sports, if I have a first time obedience competitor that is really intense and wants to do all the things, but this is going to be their first dog versus someone like you guys, that is going to look like a different dog. And you are going to be able to have different success levels with those dogs. So yeah, pick puppy is hard for me. I'm not something I usually buy into.
Well, and people should be the other thing people do, which I've seen this happen many, many times, and it never ends up working out the way they wanted, is when they make an emotional decision, right? They're like, I want a puppy now, and I know what I want. So this has happened. I know exactly what I want. Oh, what do you want? I want this, this, and this. Okay. I'm gonna go look at this litter tomorrow. I go, wait, did you even research it? No, I'll walk away. If that puppy I want, I said, okay, I'll
No,
remind
you
them.
won't.
Remember, you said you wanted a puppy that has these traits. Yes, I remember. They go, they come back with a puppy. I go, does that puppy have these traits? Well, I'm sure it'll be great or whatever. I'm like, well, did you test it? And I'll define my definition of testing, which I think may be actually similar or not to yours.
Probably.
But I'm like, did you even test it? Like, did you take it away from the other puppies one by one? Did you do this? Did you? Well, no, blah, blah, whatever. And what happens? Never happy with that dog. They're never happy with that dog because they made an emotional decision. They went in. They saw what we all see. Puppies. Who doesn't love puppies? I adore puppies. They're adorable. I loved Salty. I love that puppy. I mean, he was everything. I could tell right away. I was like, I would take this dog in a heartbeat. But I wasn't ready to take a puppy, so I wasn't going to take him. Even though he was a puppy that I was like, I would be, I know I would be very happy with this puppy. But and I was able to walk away. But like, people look at puppies, it's not what they wanted. But it's a cute puppy, and the breeder, of course, would like you to have the puppy. And they're like, oh, take the blah, 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 and off you go. And then I'm like, don't complain to me about this puppy because, you know, this was not – you have to remember, you're going to be with this dog forever.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And do you want to be happy? Like you said, no dog is going to be perfect. Like, you know – I could argue on the one hand that Zesty is a perfect puppy, but on the other hand, he's a horrible dog to live with.
Yeah.
The girls that work for me didn't like him. They just said to me, they didn't even want to potty. They did not want to even take him out to go to the bathroom because he's just a lot of dog. And he has this like singular mindset, like, want to, you know, he's very intense. He's just a lot. Anyway, he's just a lot. So I think Lori, I was talking to you about this or somebody, like all the good traits that I want for the level of performance I want come with
some some shitty life stuff.
Because those same traits are who they are. So if I want a dog like you were talking about earlier, some of those working dogs that's confident and independent, well, guess what? They're not just going to be like that when we're training.
No.
They're going to be like that all the time. Right. Or if they have a ton of drive and they're always on the edge, they're not just going to be like that in training. They're going to be like that all the time. And right. So I think I think that's what people don't understand. Or they see these pictures of Zesty, you know, with his hat on and his glasses on and looking cute as a button and all that. And I'm like, yeah, just come spend a day with me. And you'll be like, holy Hannah, like, what is even happening here? You know?
Oh, yeah.
And people don't understand that. And I think if they really did, and if all breeders would just be really honest and say, like, look, you know, you can have this, but like Zaina's breeder, I will say she's not even really a breeder. She's just bred a few litters. She wanted a puppy. She bred, you know, the litter. She knew that Zaina could not just, she, first of all, she did not want her because she knew she couldn't handle her. Like she out and out said it. Like I can't. And I kind of waited, you know, till kind of last minute to commit to her. I don't know why, but whatever. She was in a panic. She didn't tell me till after because she was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this dog because I don't have another home that could handle her.
Right.
I can't keep her because I can't handle her. So she was well aware at 5 weeks old, at 6 weeks old, and at 7 weeks old that this dog was not just going to be able to go to any home, right?
Yes.
And she was like incredibly relieved that I took her because she's like, you're probably the only person I know that could actually handle this animal. So, but this is not like bashing breeders in any way, shape or form, but it's like being realistic about the dogs and then communicating that to the clients, the purchasers, whatever you call us, crazy people
yeah.
that want dogs, that this may not be the best dog for you. And, you know, as a purchaser, like I have many times walked away from litters.
Yes.
Like, looked at the litter, walked away, and been like, no, the puppy I want is not there. And I've told breeders, like I told Jesse's breeder, I said, this is what I want. I don't care if it's not in this litter, because if it's not, I will wait till the other litter. And if the next litter is not till 6 months, I will wait 6 months. And if it's not
right.
in that litter, I'll wait for another litter. I'm not just taking any puppy. Mm-hmm. I want what I want.
Because
these they stay with me forever. They mm-hmm. live in my house. They sleep in my bed. They're with me practically 24/7. And I compete at a certain level, and I want what I want.
Yes, and not every dog can be that. We can't
right.
love them to be that. We can't train all of them to be that. They're going to have – they are who they are, right? And we talk about it in other sports, right? Like, I can't go play professional basketball. It doesn't matter how much I train for it. It doesn't matter how much whatever. I am not talented enough, and I'm not physically built enough to go do that. So we accept that. Why are we thinking that we can just manipulate a dog that is not the right fit for the task into being this perfect creature? It's an exercise in frustration. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure that we are working with breeders and someone who we trust has our best interests in mind and is not just trying to sell puppies or to get the litter all spoken for. And I do understand from the breeder perspective how tricky it can be to go, shit, I'm going to have 3 puppies left. Now, for me, I go, cool, I just raise those for police departments. Like, they're just going to hang out with me and we're going to raise them up, and maybe they'll go search and rescue. Maybe they'll go police. Maybe they'll go federal. Like, let's see what that dog wants to do. I have the staff and the facilities to go, meh, I don't have the right home for this puppy right now. Then it's going to stay back with me. Not an issue. But for a lot of breeders, that's very tricky. We can't just look and go, oh, I'll just raise an extra 2 or 3 dogs this year. Like, that's a lot. And so we feel pressure to need to get all these dogs into the right homes. And I mean, I see it. I talk to bitch owners sometimes. I have a few boys that we offer out at stud. I will talk to bitch owners. Okay, what are your plans to place this litter? And if they go, well, I have some performance inquiries and then, you know, some active pet homes and some whatever, a lot of times, and I have several boys that I'll go, okay, never mind then. Like, this is just not going to fit that, because this dog is typically going to produce a dog that is not going to be super happy as an active home or just an active pet home. And if that's where you're placing, then I think you need to reconsider your stud choice, because we're going to produce dogs that the owners are going to struggle with and the dog is going to struggle. Mm-hmm. And perhaps working in the pet side, where we do pet boarding and we do pet training too, and I have a crew of awesome pet trainers that work with me, we have to see the consequences of that, of someone who got a dog that they were told would be great to be an active hiking companion, an active, you know, fun companion that way. And now they are dealing with, you know, over arousal behaviors, reactivity, whatever it may be that usually it manifests as, because they do love to hike, but they love to hike on Saturday once a week. And then the dog, what does the dog do the rest of the week?
That active companion animal thing is a farce. I hate it.
Really,
I hate it, because you're just like, to me, it's like you are setting these people up to fail, like active companion. Like, what is that?
And then we see those people fail, and how frustrating it is for the dog and the human. And, you know, we see these people that go, this is not the dog that they wanted. And they might love it still, and most of them will make it work. But it's not the lifestyle or the dog they wanted. And why are we placing those dogs there?
I'm just laughing because it's like,
I come
in the living room and like Salty's on the fucking table, like the fucking end table, like just standing there, like they're not normal.
No. And living with these dogs is what it is. If you want to see fucking chaos right now, I'll open my back door and holy shit, the dogs that will come from everywhere and smash themselves out the door. They have door manners. Do they give a shit? No. Because, oh my God, the door got opened and maybe we're going to fucking do something.
Zessie's like
fun.
That every time I get up.
Yeah.
It's like he'll be in a dead sleep. I get up.
Yes.
He leaps over the like literally jumps over the couch, runs to the hallway, and he stands. Are you going up? Are you going in the kitchen? Are you going up? Then I head in the kitchen. He's like, are you going out the door? In the door? To the basement? Yeah. Where are you going? Where are you going? I'm like, oh my God. Like,
yes.
I don't even notice it anymore. It's normal. But I do. I also have a boarding kennel. And for a while, when I had my rehab there, we also did pet training. And like, that's when you would see these dogs come in for training. These poor owners, like well-meaning, pulling their hair out. These dogs. A complete train wreck, and it's all because it's a complete mismatch, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And now we're trying to help them. And my trainer, who is young, would come look at me like, "Who thought that?" I'm like, "Look, who thought this was a good idea?" I'm like, "I know, but all we can do now is do the best we can to help them out. But is it ever going to be ideal? Of course not. It's never going to be ideal because it was a mismatch." To begin with, like
from the beginning.
Right.
And that's where I will tell people, I mean, I get people who inquire a lot. And as a breeder, it's so sometimes hard to turn those away that you could hear this awesome home and they have property and they have a pond and they want to do this and that with the dog and they want to whatever. I know one of my dogs, it might be a beautiful piece of property. They might love to take their dogs on walks. They might love to do all these things. It's not the right home. And I will turn down those homes. I will absolutely help. I have a few other breeders that I will refer them to. And I go, here, this person produces dogs that you are going to really enjoy. But they don't want the crack addict that because there's a pond in the backyard and they go to move any bit towards the backyard and that dog is just screaming and racing into the pond no matter the time of year. They don't want that dog. And they might think they want that dog, but that dog's not actually going to be super enjoyable for them to live with. It's going to be a lot more management than what they want to put into it. And most people want a dog because they want a dog to enrich and bring joy to their life.
Right.
Some of my dogs do not bring joy to my life. Like working them might bring joy to my life, but living with them does not bring joy to my life.
And I always like, I go back to, I'm like, there's like winters where like I check the weather and I'm like, fuck, like it's going to fucking ice for 3 days. Like what? I go to a panic, you know, like where you're like, holy shit, how am I going to get these dogs out? How am I going to live with these dogs? Like that's a thing. That's the reality of living with them.
But there are, so now that we frighten everyone away, they'll never get a working lab again. I mean, but it's all a matter of what's being bred because zeal is the polar opposite, right?
Yep.
Zeal is, I call it lazy. You know, I'm like, he's the laziest dog on the planet in life because he is perfectly content to literally spend the entire day on his bed chewing his bone. Now, when I work him, he's all in. When I hike him, he's like full 13 and a half hour, 10 minutes into the hike. He's still running. Like he's been running the whole time. Right. But I come home, he's affectionate. He loves people. He was well-mannered. The dog is like the perfect dog. He never did a naughty thing ever in his entire life. Like not even as a puppy, he did not do a single naughty thing. He was like, and people would look at him and go, he's an old soul. Like he, I have pictures of him as, but like he would be loose at work. I'd be working. I'd be having WrestleMania with some crazy dog that didn't want to be restrained that I need to work on. And he'd just sit there calmly and look like watching, like, why is this dog being so crazy? I don't understand. So they're there. It's a matter of you need to understand the difference and you need to be like a really smart shopper and look for that dog because that dog will fit your lifestyle better. You'll be much happier with that dog and you'll still be able to work with that dog. This dog can still be very competitive. You can still be very successful with the dog, but it's just going to be, it's just a different experience. Right. And then you're like, well, why would you, I mean, Zeal, I like the crackheads because it matches my personality. Because you know, and Zeal had his own challenges. All dogs have challenges when we're training them. They're, they were just very different. So people just, I think we circle all the way back around to what you said at the beginning, which is you need to have a list, right? You need to have a clear understanding of exactly what you want, not some vague concept of pick of the litter, air quotes around it, right? Like, you should be able to write down and say, this is what I want in life, and this is what I want in my working dog, and this is realistically my skill level, because you have to be realistic about that.
Absolutely.
And this is my lifestyle, and this is realistically the amount of time I can dedicate to training and to exercising my dog and to life management training skills, etc., right? Because
absolutely,
if you don't have that, it's like you're walking into a forest with zero direction. Like, you're just standing there in the woods. Like, I don't even
you
know
don't have the structure, and you're at the mercy of just whoever is able to sell you a good story or mm-hmm. sell you a good, you know, description. And, you know, though it's so icky to think about because it's animals and it's a welfare thing and all of that, we do have to go at the end of the day. Breeders are trying to sell you a puppy. You are the consumer who is trying to buy a puppy. Mm-hmm. If you have a specific list, if you were going to buy a car and had your checklist of all the things you wanted, you would not be sold an emotional story to get a car that is a completely different make and model and year than you wanted, mm-hmm. because you need a car that is going to meet your list. With a puppy, I think it's so much easier to get sucked into the emotional side of, oh, it's super cute, or there was some crazy story behind the litter, or there was, you know, just some other thing that made it meant to be. And then we just throw our list away completely and go, this is what we need. This is what I'm going to get. And make that a decision based on either impulse or emotion. There are breeders out there. There are so many breeders of dogs. You can find what you are looking for if you wait long enough and you are yeah. persistent enough in your search. And you have to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And be patient.
I mean, my second dog I ever got, like, I knew nothing, right? And so anyway, we go to this breeder's house and she starts telling us, so I wasn't doing performance. So she starts telling us about champions and, you know, pedigrees, and showing us glossy pictures in this magazine. And we were like, wow,
yep.
you know, and then she shows us this litter and they're so darn cute. Of course they're cute. They're puppies, right? Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, okay. So long story short, we buy the dog. Come to find out way later, the dog was dysplastic, right? But we got, like, I didn't know, right? I just didn't mm-hmm. know. And yeah. so mm-hmm. talk about, like, I got sold a story, right? Because I didn't educate myself. I didn't know what I wanted. And I was just looking for a pet. Not that that makes it okay, but, you know, but case in point, like, I got distracted by the fancy magazine cover and the letters in the behind the, in front of, like, probably in front of the dog's name. I don't even remember. Champion, yeah. whatever. And the story she sold about, like, how great this litter was and all this stuff. Like, and we just believed her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. would I have believed somebody, like you said, if I went to buy a car just on the word alone or something? Probably not. But I don't know why. We just probably, because she's an authority figure in the sense that she quote unquote knows what she's talking about, mm-hmm. and I quote unquote didn't. This was pre-internet. I'm old, in all fairness to myself. It's not like I could have gone and Googled it, right? But nowadays, for sure, you could at least Google health clearances and stuff like that.
Right.
But
absolutely.
It's just an example of, like, kind of not being the most educated consumer, not getting all the information first, and mm-hmm. then being discriminating, right?
Yep.
Like, and then getting innocently sucked in, right? Because mm-hmm. you just didn't know any better.
Yeah. Well, and I think other point I'm going to bring up before we get off that topic is, you know, the breeders also only know what the breeders know. And so we can see there are some phenomenal breeders who are fantastic at producing field champions and produce these beautiful field champions and consistently do so and have top pedigrees for doing so. That's great. Some of them have a good awareness of what other sports entail. But if you go to some of those, if I went to some of those as a detection, looking for a detection prospect, and I said, I want you to sell me your puppy that's going to be the best fit for detection, and just left it at that, Do they actually know what I'm looking for in a detection
No.
prospect? Do they know what I need my final product to be? Do they
Right.
know what I need, what traits I need most strongly for my dogs? And does the sport that they are competing in or trialing dogs in, which is a completely different sport, does that sport actually reward the traits that I am looking for? Because often there can be some crossover generalizations, but it's not fully exactly the creature I'm looking for. And we don't have breeders for the most part that are breeding like specifically for competition obedience,
Right.
working labs just for competition obedience. So we do need to look at breeders that are pulling from other working disciplines. But then we need to be able to articulate, hey, I am doing competition obedience. These are the traits that I need, and this is what is most important to me. And we need to make sure that breeder understands how those traits are going to affect the dog, the final product, your training methods, all of that, to be able to send you the dog that is actually going to work for you. Because if we just go, oh, they're looking for a competition obedience dog, so they're looking for a calm dog that's very biddable and a little soft and listens to directions well, that might not be the dog at all that you need it to be, but that's the assumption or the stereotype and or just what they think. And so we can't just say I'm looking for a competition obedience prospect and leave it at that. We need to be able to articulate what traits are important, why they are important, and then as a consumer, we need to be honest if that litter is going to meet that needs or not.
Yeah, that's so funny that you said that. As soon as you said that, I went, oh, I'll bet you that's why way back I learned to sit down and articulate exactly what I want, because I was getting my dogs from field trial breeders and I knew they had no idea what I was doing. None, and no idea what I was looking for in a dog and all these things. And I knew some of them wouldn't even sell me a dog, which I was fine with. But I knew that I needed to be very clear and able to say, this is what I want out of a dog. Because if exactly like you said, if I just said I do obedience, they would have absolutely no idea what I wanted.
Which is like, I think, I don't know if you agree, like most breeders have their, their disciplines that they're primarily breeding for. Kate, it's really like we're super lucky with you because you did do all that stuff. Like you did obedience, you did agility, you
Oh,
did
not on your
breed. So,
levels, but
but
I'm lucky
you,
to have friends like you guys who do it
yeah,
on that
and
level and can educate
yeah.
me.
And educate you. But I really think like it's super important for people going to look for puppies. Like if you're not sure, if you just don't have the experience, like I don't have as much experience as Petra, like have find somebody who can help you. Absolutely, that was a game changer, like when Petra was able to come with me and pick out Salty.
So have you talked to people about how we picked out Salty and what happened
Well,
to
no,
Salty
so
there?
that's what I really want to get into. No, because what happens is, right, because I, well, all right, so way back when I first started looking at litters, just out of sheer curiosity for myself, for other people, whatever, like it was like, oh, we do this formal testing, right? Like, and then other people develop these other tests, whatever. So we would do these tests. But then, I had a client in my rehab facility, and she was the director of the Seeing Eye. And so we talked about, and it was really interesting. She said, those tests, she says, we don't use them. They're not predictive of whether or not the dog is going to be successful in the program. She goes, what I find was more successful was I was just able to look at the puppies myself and I could tell. And then I said, well, how could you tell? She goes, well, we're just looking at behavior. And then she said the reason she doesn't think the tests were effective is because the people administering it are still interpreting behavior and they may not be interpreting the behavior correctly. And I was like, oh, I get it. And I said, yeah, so like really, I don't need to do the test. I need to just have the ability to read the dog and read the dog's behavior, right? So, yes. So, a couple things. One is I believe this. I was taught this. I don't know if there was a study on it or if it's just hearsay. In my personal experience, again, that's all it is, just one of one, me, right? Like what you see with the puppy between 5 and 7 weeks old in the litter, in the pack, is not the same as what you necessarily is what you will see when you take them out one by one
Agreed.
away from their litter mates and optimally in a spot they have not been in prior. So, you know, if they've never been in this room or this building or in this yard, take each puppy individually out one by one. And so what I started doing after a while was I would just take it was like completely informal, right? Like I would just take that puppy out and we just walk through wherever we were. And there would maybe be some obstacles there, whatever. It wasn't like even that formal. And I would just observe each puppy. And when you would take each one by one by one, you will see a clear difference in their personalities, a clear difference in their behaviors. And all in essence, all I'm doing is looking at this puppy's behavior, right? So with Salty, so we you know when they're in a group, they're all cute, they all, you know, whatever. And Lori was like, I like this girl. What was the pink or the purple one? I like this
The
girl.
red
And I'm
one,
like,
yeah.
red. And in my head, I'm like, how do you even know? Like, because it was in a puppy pile, right? So I said, well, I'd like to. You know, even though Lori was claiming she didn't want a puppy out of this litter, I said, if Kate's amenable, I'd like to take them out one by one and take them in a spot they haven't been. So we met at Caitlin's house. The puppies were all in their in a big crate. And we took, and Lori wanted, I know Lori likes her girls, right? Which is fine. So we took out one girl and basically, the puppy comes out of the car, put it on the floor. And then we all walk through her yard. We walked past a kennel with some barking dogs. One of them is a big shepherd, rah, 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 right? And then we all just walked together. And then there were some woods and a little rock wall. And then there were some tables and chairs and whatever. It was nothing fancy, nothing. Maybe there was a toy laying around, a dirty old toy, like in the yard. This was completely not formal, right? And I'm 300% fine with that because all I do is read dogs for my job, right? So put the girl down and we start walking. Is the dog constantly underfoot? Okay, that's a dog that's really going to rely on the handler, right? It's like it's not confident enough to go explore the environment on its own. It wants to be by you. Is that good? Is that bad? It just is, right? Like this is how this dog is. Does the dog go? The dog goes, rah, 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 and the puppy goes, ah, and then it goes, oh, it's just a barking dog. I'm good. Is that bad? Is that good? It just is what it is, right? It's a simple response. I'm just observing behavior, right? And then you take out the next puppy and you see the difference. Oh, this one's a little more confident. Does this puppy take off and go sayonara and you're like puppy puppy and it's like yeah I could care less about you. All right, well it is what it is. This puppy's going to be extremely independent. It's very confident, has no problem exploring the environment. It's not that concerned about you. Right, might be good for some people, might not be good for other people, right? Like it
But
is
like you
what
said, it
it is.
just is what it is. It's
It
not
is
a
what it is.
quantifying this is a bad puppy or a good puppy. This is just who this puppy is. And now we figure out where that puppy should go.
Right. And then so we looked at the different girls. Now I know what I would want in a high end, and by high end I don't mean it like in a snooty way. I mean it in a dog that's going to be asked to do work that's extremely complicated, because we don't just want to go to obedience competitions. We want to go to tournaments. Right, we want to go to high pressure situations where this dog is going to have to perform over and over, day after day, under super challenging conditions and hold it together, right? So I understand exactly what that requires, right? And I know that's what Lori wants. So that's what I'm looking for when I'm looking at these puppies, right? And so we're looking at the girls and I'm like, the one girl, I liked her, but I'm like, I'm not sure if this is what I would want, right? For what that kind of situation. So we looked at the three girls and then Caitlin snuck out a boy, right? And
tried to sneak out a boy.
Puts him on the ground. He's on the ground. I don't know how long, Caitlin.
Oh, it's 3 seconds, right?
And I'm literally. Oh my God, I love this puppy. And Lori's like, you just like him because he's a boy. And I'm like, I go, just watch. And I'm looking at Caitlin. Caitlin's like,
Right? And I'm over here trying to hide the fact that he has a penis. I'm like,
I know. And I'm like, wait a second. Girl. I'm like, Kate, what do you do? What is this? Is this a boy? You're like, well, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. And then, so we start, what is it? This second he hit the ground, he stands there and he goes, I own the world.
Yeah.
He's like confident. His chest is out. He's got a certain amount of twitch, which means it's like drive that we talked about, right? Like he's going to work all day and all night for you. Now, I also can tell pretty quickly, this is going to be a handful. Not anyone can handle this dog. I said, this dog is going to fight you on certain things. It's like, especially as they get older, that's in him. I can see it now. The big bad dog barks at him. He stands there, looks at the dog, and is like, who do you think you are barking at, dude?
Yeah.
Like, no startle, no concern, holds his ground, like, puh, you ain't scaring me, right? Just super confident, but checks in, which I like a lot, right? And fearless, just has this thing about him where I'm like, these are all the traits that I would want and would need in a puppy that's going to be doing the things that Lori's going to ask him to do. I also know that Lori hikes her dogs a lot. I know that she understands arousal and can manage it, you know, and all these things. So because I can see in that short amount of time, not just who this puppy is now, but who this puppy is going to be, pros and cons, right? Because like we said, with the pros come some cons. Like with Absolutely. A dog that humps everything under the sun, well, he's humping it not just because he wants to have sex with it. He's humping it because he's like, dude, I own you, right? And he's going to try and hump you and own you. Like that is going to happen, right? So you better be the kind of handler that knows how to handle that and can nip that in the butt. Like, and so all these things. So it's, I am looking at personality traits, dog behavior, because dog behavior is dog behavior. And like we said, like who this dog is now is who this dog is going to be. You're not going to change this dog and turn it into let's just cuddle on the couch all day, right? He is who he is. And right. Now, not that there, some of those other puppies that I saw would be great performance prospects with different handlers, right?
Where Absolutely. They
could be extremely successful. The handler could be super happy with them. The dog could have a super fulfilling life. It doesn't mean that Salty was quote unquote pick of the litter. He actually probably was not, in terms of if you look across the board of like the average person that's looking to buy one of your puppies, like because he's kind of off the charts, right?
Yeah, he would actually be a puppy for me in many situations. If I didn't have someone like a Lori in this case, I would go, this is not a puppy I'm confident placing out. He's staying back with me to raise up and probably to go into a detection career, because he's going to get returned. He's going to be a problem. And that's what it is.
Yeah. And so it's really, so it's anyone, if you really think about it, anyone could do that, Right, as long as you can objectively read dog behavior. Now you must be objective, right? Because again, we
Right.
have the cuteness factor. We have the puppy that's going to go, I love you, I love you, I love you, right? Like you have to be able to be objective. And if you can't, bring someone with you that can, that is just going to look at behavior and read behavior, right? Because that's all we were doing, and Caitlin, that's what you're doing too, right? In
That
essence.
is what I absolutely. So I don't do like a formal temperament test with my puppies. It is all just putting them in new situations and novel situations individually and seeing how they respond. And also looking at them and playing with them individually because that tells me so much more than how they play in the litter. And
Yeah.
those things kind of combine to look at how is this puppy interacting with the world? How are they interacting with me? How are they interacting with a motivator? And then we do also have to look at the structural point too. If you're telling me you want a, high-end agility prospect, and I don't send you a dog with the proper shoulder angulation to be able to handle that, then I don't care how talented the dog is, it's going to break down and you're going to have issues. So we have to look at that piece of it too. And it's very hard. It can be very hard to find the ideal. And then I think just the other piece to keep in mind for people. If we are looking at a litter, I have a good friend right now who has a puppy that got given to him from kind of show low-level hunt test type lines. And the puppy looks phenomenal, or looked phenomenal as a puppy for kind of a detection prospect. It was checking all the boxes. I have to have some reserves because genetically I go, both parents and the whole breadth of pedigree through here is not capable of doing this job. Maybe this dog is a genetic anomaly, and it is, but it gives me some red flags. And that puppy now is 7 months old and flattened out, and is going to probably stay flattened out because it looked really cool as a puppy, but it is maturing to what its genetics are allowing it to mature to, and that's not the level that we would like it to be.
Kate,
So,
just explain what flattened out is to some of our listeners who may not really
yeah.
understand that term.
Yeah, so the puppy looked, it had enough arousal when it was younger to mask, to kind of carry it through and make it look pretty flashy when it was a younger puppy in some tasks. And now that it's maturing out, we're starting to see the dog is pretty quick to quit and give up in situations where we need it to kind of push through. It will not always be super resilient to stress. It's pretty amenable to go, eh, that's just not. The juice ain't worth the squeeze. It's that's too much effort to have to put in to do that. And it is what it is. It's we can't pretend it's a surprise. Both parents were very laid back, mellow, easy dogs to be around, not dogs that were putting a ton of effort into any type of task. And this puppy is going to mature to probably be a little bit more than its parents, but not genetically what we're looking for a detection dog, so.
Yeah, and I think it always it keeps circling around to you need to know what you need to know exactly what you want and what you're going to do with the dog, right? Because like different tasks require different personality traits or different skill sets or different levels of drive. And so you need to be clear, like this or these are the sport or sports I'm going to do. This is what's required for those sports. And if you're not sure, don't talk to everybody, but talk to some really experienced people or, some of people that have the ability to be objective and say, okay, these are the traits that I need for this sport. And you need to trust them because I can't tell you how many times people have asked me and I've said, and I pour my heart and soul into like trying to help them. And then they go and do what I didn't said not to do. And then I'm like, oh, good Lord. And right, because you need to know exactly what you're going to do, what this dog needs to do, what your lifestyle is. You need to be honest about it. You need to be objective about it to be fair to yourself and to the animal, right? Because otherwise, you're just setting yourself up for a dog's lifetime of frustration, disappointment, which is going to absolutely affect your relationship with the dog, and it's going to affect the dog, and it's going to impact the dog's life. No matter how you slice it, it's going to have an impact on that dog. So really, and we're responsible for their well-being, right? Like, once I commit to buying a dog, no matter what, I had a dog that I purchased, I did all my due diligence, the whole nine yards. Turns out the dog just chemically was not wired right, right? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That's my dog. Right. I kept that dog until the day he died, and I had to adapt and adjust and do, I mean, I have thanked the universe a million times for bringing that dog to me, because he would probably have been euthanized, or who knows what would have happened to him, because he was so complicated. But I was in a unique position that I was able to deal with it. And I did agility with him. I hated agility with a passion, but it was like the only thing like he could do, and he loved it more than life itself. And he had all these unique needs that I had to deal with and figure out, and he had dietary issues, on and on and on. Like, but in my mind, that is my child. I am committed to this thing. And so even with having done everything, that's what I ended up with. Okay, fine. I pivoted and I adapted. But a lot of people can't pivot, adapt, or they don't have the resources. They don't have the, not whatever the case, you know. And so you should put a lot of effort in and a lot of objectivity into trying to get the best possible match so that you and the dog are happy together.
Absolutely.
100%. Absolutely.
And it's definitely just as much your responsibility as the breeder's. Like, I think sometimes we give all the power away to the breeder. And it's not that, like, look, I have been extremely fortunate that other than that pet dog that was dysplastic, that I've had exceptional breeders. But part of the reason I went with them is because I had conversations with them, and we talked about what I wanted, and I made sure that they heard me and that they understood me and that we were on the same page.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think we have to be able to have that mutual trust and respect in both directions, where I can respect that you know what you are looking for in a puppy, and your traits that you're saying are important to you are important to you. And because that matters. If I'm just discounting and going, oh, yeah, that's what you're saying, but meh, this is what I think needs to happen, that doesn't help the situation. You are a competent and informed buyer, and you deserve to have your list of things that is respected, and that list should be met. And we also need to have breeders who are willing to admit when they do not have a puppy that is going to fit that situation, and be able to say that and articulate that and not feel the pressure to have to send this person a puppy just because they have to send this person a puppy. It can be a funny situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, definitely. At the end of the day, we're all human, right? Like, and we're dealing with humans. So breeders are humans. You know, the seller's a human, the buyer's a human, right? And like with everything across the spectrum, there are going to be people that are providing a good service and people that are providing a poor service, right? Mm-hmm. And there are going to be buyers that are very experienced and very knowledgeable, that are confident and self-assured, and there are going to be those that aren't. And if you're not, then you should get help. Like, that's the way I look at it, right? Is like, if you're not, like, way back when I didn't know, I wanted to learn, right? I picked people's brains constantly. Just like this, my friend from the Seeing Eye, I was like, oh, like, I just wanted to pick her brain all day and all night, not just about puppies, about everything. Like, right? That's how we should be. We should be endlessly curious. Yeah. We should be endlessly trying to get more information. And if we don't have it, or we don't feel confident, or we're not self-assured, then find somebody who is, take them with you, let them help you, right? Like, who doesn't want to go look at, like, I'm a sucker. Like, oh, will you come look at, sure, I'll come look at puppies. I don't care. They're puppies. Like, who doesn't want to spend the, you know, a few hours or a day, like, hanging out with puppies?
Puppies.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Ugh. Well, this has been great. I think we're at.
Wait, oh my God.
We're Kate, way over. Kate's like, oh boy.
Kate's like, I actually have a life.
Oh no, we're good.
No.
Oh no, I'm actually planning my next hike of the next dogs that need to go get
there
out
go.
And do things yeah. so that go. We can have sanity. Yes, but that's, no, wow. it's all good. This was fun.
It was fun.
Awesome. Thank
it
you
is.
so much. There's so yeah. much good information.
So much.
I know it's going to help a lot of people. So
definitely.
We really appreciate. And people, support the juniors because look what it produces. Yes.
Absolutely.
If you see juniors
support
out
juniors.
There, support them because this is what we get out of it. And then
absolutely.
That gives back to our, dog community.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It all comes full circle. And we don't get people that are coming into this industry, you know, just... Young people coming into this industry should be supported. And sometimes you may not realize how just a kind word or giving someone yeah. the opportunity to talk to them after they come out of the ring, or even to get to watch you train your dog or to play with some of these higher end dogs, that makes a difference and that makes an impression. And giving those opportunities are really what opens doors and sometimes to really cool places. So it's yeah. great to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said. Thanks, Kate. So
thanks,
so
Kate.
Much.
Thank you guys very much.
Was
this
great.
Was fun. Absolutely. Thank you guys.
All right. All go right. hike your dogs.
Yes.
Yeah, everybody, go hike your dogs and good luck with your next puppy.
That's right.
That's it.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.